When you're looking for a new computer or need help with one you already own, call 231-8000 and Madison Computer Works will get things up and running for you. Madison Computer Works, computers that work for you.
Welcome to another podcast. It's LiesOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers, also Madison Teachers and Madison Firefighters and Madison Teamsters Local 695. Joining us now, one of the eight candidates remaining in the Democratic field, obviously the primary coming up August 14th, Kelda Royce. She is a lawyer from Madison and got into the race relatively late compared to some of the others, and yet she's probably one of the last three or four real contenders as we kind of get to the final moments of this race. Kelda, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you, Sly.
So you came out of the gate, and I'm watching how each candidate decides to run ads and focus on this race. You came out of the gate immediately talking about Donald Trump's Supreme Court pick and choice. Why did you lead with that?
Well, we've been campaigning for 9 months or so all around the state, and I've been listening and hearing what Wisconsinites are concerned about. And what I hear over and over again is people want to feel proud of Wisconsin again. They want us to be a place where every family can thrive, a place that values public education and health care. And, you know, of course, they're very concerned about what's happening in this country. You know, the Supreme Court pick means that a whole host of things are under attack. We're likely to see more rollbacks of women's rights, of LGBT equality, of labor rights and protections for workers and consumers. These things are really top of mind to Wisconsin voters, and we all know what's at stake in this election.
Now, PolitiFact decided to critique your ad, saying it's mostly false because abortion isn't illegal in Wisconsin. And of course, you and I both know that it's on the books. Abortion is very much illegal in Wisconsin without the protection of the Roe v. Wade 1973 decision. As a matter of fact, I think there was probably a time where birth control was illegal in Wisconsin. There's some really draconian things on the books in the Wisconsin laws, including women can be punished for cheating on their husbands.
Well, you know, it is very scary because most people, everybody knows abortion is illegal because of Roe v. Wade. But what most people don't realize, and what I was shocked to learn as a first-year law student almost 20 years ago when I opened up my big fat statute book, is that right there in the criminal code, it says abortion. Wisconsin statute 940.04, abortion is a crime. And if the only thing that is protecting people from being prosecuted under this very cruel law, which doesn't contain any exceptions for rape or incest or, you know, the health of the woman, the only thing protecting us from that is Roe versus Wade. And we know that we just need this one vacancy on the Supreme Court to have a vote to overturn Roe versus Wade. And that means abortion will immediately become a crime again in Wisconsin. It's become illegal again. It's already a crime.
Well, as a matter of fact, both the Republicans running for the U.S. Senate have supported that very draconian level of restriction on abortion, including prohibiting it in cases where the life of the mother is in danger, which is, this is crazy stuff.
Well, and Governor Walker has also supported a no exception ban on abortion. They want to criminalize abortion and go back to a time when, you know, women died because they didn't have access to safe abortion care. What's even worse, I think, though, is that they oppose all the things that would actually reduce the need for abortion. You know, I want to see people have access to great health care. I want to make sure everyone who has birth control or needs birth control has access to it. I want to make sure that women who already have a kid or two and don't feel they can afford another one don't feel they have to make the decision to have an abortion because they don't have any family leave and child care is not affordable and they can't put food on the table. I think we need to do everything we can as a society to reduce the need for abortion. But I don't think the way to do that is criminalize it, make it more difficult and dangerous.
It's interesting. During the Walker regime, they've really found a way to cut off money to a lot of family planning clinics, and a lot of clinics that were open in places like Beaver Dam, they're gone.
You're right. You know, and it's defunding Planned Parenthood, but also trying to destroy access to health care for Wisconsinites. You know, Walker didn't take the federal tax dollars that should have been coming back into our state to help cover people and expand health insurance coverage to something like 80,000 Wisconsinites. It would have also created, you know, thousands of health care jobs that saved state taxpayers $1 billion, but he didn't want that money. And so now we've got fewer people with any health care coverage. We've got fewer health care jobs, and state taxpayers are on the hook for something like $1 billion.
How do you thread the needle when you're running for governor, though? Because you're not running in just Madison and Milwaukee. You're running statewide. And there are pockets of the state, maybe not as many as there used to be, where there are Democrats that are opposed to legalized abortion. Now, they've never made as much of an emphasis on it, and I'm not really sure if you asked them, they'd say they want to terminate the right. But out of sentiment or religious belief, they're squeamish about abortion. How do you thread that needle when you're running statewide?
You know, Sly, I think that's a great and really important question. I understand probably more than most people, because I was the head of NARAL, and even in my own family, I have people who deeply disagree and feel strongly about this issue on many sides. I think we have to respect people's personal beliefs about abortion, about the right to choose, and that is precisely why we cannot have politicians meddling in these very personal, private family decisions. And everywhere I go, I mean, I know from having worked all around this state, traveled all around the state, having family all around the state, that there are a diversity of opinions on a lot of different political issues. But overwhelmingly, this is a state that is pro-choice, and it does not, we do not want to go back to a time when abortion was illegal and women couldn't obtain safe abortion care. We do want to make sure our leaders do everything we can to make sure people have access to affordable health care, and that we're reducing the need for abortion. That's the common ground that we can all agree on.
I don't know if you know this, but when I was a little boy and we lived in Milwaukee, I was born in Milwaukee. My mother was the chair. It was a volunteer position, but she was the head chair of the board of directors of Planned Parenthood, and that's where she got to know Val Phillips. So I was raised in a pro-choice house. Yeah, she was a pioneer. I mean, this is late. This is late 50s, early 60s, so she was way ahead of her time.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, it's a lot of pioneering women have worked for generations to bring us to where we are, and I don't want to go backwards.
So is there a generational shift going on? I get the sense, you know, a lot of people focus right, left. I get the feeling that a lot of people kind of want a new generation of people to come in. They're not looking backwards. They're sort of looking forward this year, and I see it in the assembly race in my district, and I see it going on in the Cortez race out in New York. You think people are looking for a different generation?
You know, I think that people are looking for politicians who speak to younger voters. I mean, you know, I think there's a lot of hand-wringing about younger voters not being engaged or not voting, and I just think that's false. I think we need political leaders who understand that the economy for people in their 20s and 30s and 40s is not the same as it was for people who are 60 or 70 or 80. It's not, you know, we're not living in the same kind of economy that our parents and grandparents had, and we need political leaders who respond to that. And at the top of the list is addressing the student loan debt crisis. You know, that is a huge change for my generation, Gen X, and for our friends, the millennials, from, you know, for instance, the baby boomers or the greatest generation, who really were able to work their way through college or leave without really having much debt. And now, you know, we all have this huge economic millstone around our neck if we were fortunate enough to even be able to get a higher education. So we need our political leaders to respond to things like student loan debt, climate change, affordable child care, you know, affordable housing and transit, issues that are really top of mind to Generation X and millennial voters, in the same way that, you know, we've been, I think, pretty good about standing up for defending Social Security and Medicare for seniors.
Is there a difference between you and your opponents on any glaring issues now that you've been out on the campaign trail for 9 months?
Well, I would say there's a lot of differences between me and Scott Walker, namely.
Oh no, I was talking about your primary opponents.
Oh.
I know there's all kinds of differences between you and Scott.
How much time do we have here? There are policy differences. I'm a firm believer in labor unions. I've been a strong defender of the right to collectively bargain. I've been a champion for the rights of women. I think public education is a big differentiator in this race. I believe public dollars are for public schools, period. I want to stop privatization. I do want to expand access to higher education to everyone. I don't think we need to make it harder for low-income people to access, for instance, our two-year technical colleges. So there are definitely some policy differences among me and some of the other candidates in the Democratic primary. Overwhelmingly, of course, any one of us would be much better than Scott Walker. But at this point, I think we really need to get serious about who can actually beat Scott Walker. Who has put together a campaign that can win? Who's a great communicator? Who is able to reach the voters that we need in order to get from, 47% of the vote, which we've gotten the last couple of times against Walker, to 53-54% of the vote, so we can actually win. And the way we do that is by energizing Democratic voters, having a candidate that people are actually excited to go cast a vote for and that they're willing to show up even in their busy lives, having a candidate who reaches younger voters, and that, by that I mean voters under 50, so that, we're voting in higher shares just like the baby boomers do, and reaching the real swing voters in Wisconsin, which are women. Specifically suburban married women. These are the voters who have voted for Walker before but are most likely to desert him and vote for a Democratic candidate if there's a candidate that they can relate to.
Do you get any flack as you travel around the state because you're from Madison?
The only place where people are really concerned about that, honestly, is Madison.
Are you saying we have a complex?
Well, I mean, I think we've internalized these Republican talking points and attacks. I mean, I actually was talking to John Nichols recently, and he said, Kelda, I look back at this, of course, but virtually all the major Democratic candidates are from Madison who are running in this governor's race. He said, I look back, and he said every Democratic governor, I think in his lifetime, was someone who was from Madison or Dane County.
Yeah, the last one would have been John Reynolds, who was from Green Bay, and that was in the early 60s. So it's been quite a while.
Yeah, but I think he was living, spent his adult life in Dane County.
In Dane County, yeah.
So, listen, the Republicans, we know what they're going to do. They're going to attack our nominee relentlessly. They're going to spin all kinds of lies and falsehoods. What we have to do is have somebody who is not afraid of that and can stand up to it, just like I've stood up for reproductive rights, just like I've gone on Fox National News, gone toe-to-toe on the O'Reilly factor with, Laura Ingraham. We need someone who can break through that and someone who can inspire national partners to come in Wisconsin and invest. Groups like Emily's List and NARAL for Choice America, and progressive leaders and champions like Diane Ravitch, who's a public education champion, just endorsed my candidacy. I've got support from Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York. I've earned support from a lot of celebrities who are really excited about what Wisconsin can be. I mean, Bon Iver and Bradley Whitford and, Sarah Silverman and a lot of folks like that.
See, so I didn't even know how, I'm so old, I didn't even know how to pronounce Bon Iver.
Well,
I haven't listened to their music.
Yes. Well, it's great music for all seasons. And, what they've done for Wisconsin is exactly the kind of, creative, innovative, economic development that happens, that we need basically to move Wisconsin forward.
All right, we'll take a break. Kelda Roy is with us. She is a candidate for governor here at SlysOffice.com.
I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
Injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh.
John and I approach personal injury cases in the same way. We want to be certain that our clients are treated fairly, that our clients are comfortable, that our clients know they can trust us to get the best result for them.
It's our professional responsibility to make certain you are fairly and fully compensated. Most of our cases are settled without a trial.
Call injury lawyers Mike Riley and John Walsh at 257-5661 for the personal attention you deserve.
We're back with Kel DeRoyce. She is one of the candidates, former state representative from Madison, running for governor. The election's coming up quick, August 14th. Here at SlysOffice.com, we've interviewed a number of the candidates that are running for governor. I want to ask you a little bit about economic development. Things are kind of tricky. Everybody's against the Foxconn deal. Your opponent, Matt Flynn, thinks that he can kill it. Others say that, no, you're going to have to restrict it. Other people have different nuanced views on it. What is your views on constraining this Foxconn situation?
Well, I think this is going to be an enormous challenge for our next governor. I think we need to be as responsible and strategic in extracting ourselves from this terrible deal as we were irresponsible and Walker was selfish in getting into it. I think we need an all-hands-on-deck approach that is going to include enforcing the Great Lakes Compact and working with the provinces and other states that are our partners in the compact. I think it's going to include litigation, potentially, on some of the issues that Matt Flynn has talked about, but also on things like the abuse of eminent domain power, which is when the government basically comes in and says, we're going to take your private property and use it for a public purpose, like if they want to build a road. But instead, they're not doing that. They're doing it and giving us land to Foxconn.
Well, it looks like Mount Pleasant didn't even go that. I mean, that is a I thought the Kelo decision was terrible, and there were a couple liberals in the U.S. Supreme Court that voted for that, and I was very mad about that. But putting that aside for a minute, it looks like the municipality of Mount Pleasant actually just declared perfectly good homes blighted and didn't even give these people a chance. Don't you think we need some change in state statutes so that can never happen again?
Well, you know, what they did, I believe, contravenes our existing state statutes, because we do have a state statute basically responds to the Kelo versus New London decision and says we can't just take somebody's home and turn it over to a private corporation for development. And I actually had the opportunity to go down to Mount Pleasant and tour one of the homes that, you know, is under threat from Foxconn. Kim and Jim Mahoney, they had saved for 9 years and planned to build their dream home. And, you know, it was a beautiful home, not fancy, not big, a modest home, but a lovely home, brand new. They had lived in it for less than a year when they got notice on their daughter's birthday, hey, you're going to be evicted to make way for Foxconn. So that is wrong. We need a governor who's going to stand up for people, the people's rights, and not sell us out to some foreign corporation.
Let me ask you your opinion on what's going on with Kimberly Clark. Obviously, it's crucial we keep paper jobs in Wisconsin. Scott Walker has completely fallen down. And thank God for the United Steelworkers. I'll give them a plug because they sponsor our podcast. But
they deserve it
for keeping Appleton.
Rather plus, because if it wasn't for the workers, you know, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Right,
steelworkers and the workers themselves.
Right. So Kimberly Clark is a deal that sort of split the Democrats. I read that you want to go back to the negotiating table and come up with a different deal. What would you do in the Kimberly Clark situation?
Well, listen, I mean, I think we have to respect the tremendous work and concessions that the workers made to keep jobs and keep, keep the plants open. And that means we need to, if we're going to be asked to put public resources and taxpayer dollars in, we need to make sure that there are protections for taxpayers and protections for workers. I don't think we should be doing corporate welfare deals where we don't have, you know, adequate protections in place for workers, for taxpayers, for the public. It's ineffective. We know that from decades of data. You know, it's not a great way to create jobs and get a good return on our public investment. And it really is disrespectful to the workers who went to the table and really gave up tremendous concessions to keep that plan open.
Your former colleague, now Minority Leader Gordon Hinds, has been on the warpath for a very long time about the manufacturing and agriculture tax credit that the Republicans mm-hmm. have given, because he said, you know, it's not being used to create jobs, it's just being used to enrich people. How do we mm-hmm. keep manufacturing jobs? And, you know, and again, with PolitiFact and some of the games they were playing with the loss of manufacturing jobs, but every time I drive by Oscar Mayer, I see, yes, we lost manufacturing jobs, and there's plants all over the state that we have, that we've lost, partly because of bad trade deals on a federal level, but also the governor's inattention. How do we keep manufacturing jobs in this state?
Well, I think we need to look at where Wisconsin has strengths, and we need a governor who isn't asleep at the wheel on this. We need to help companies who are here succeed and keep the doors open. But we also need to do what I think Wisconsin has not done in recent years, and that is help encourage new innovative businesses to start here in Wisconsin. You know, we need, think about the $3 billion for Foxconn. If we had taken that $3 billion rather than turning it over to one foreign corporation, but instead we had invested in $100,000 each in 30,000 new businesses, that would mean that in each of Wisconsin's 72 counties, you'd have over 400 new businesses with $100,000 in capital that they could use to make investments in those communities, to hire workers. Just think about the economic activity it would mean to have 400 new businesses in every county across Wisconsin. We need to unleash the power of our entrepreneurs, small business owners in this state, because that, all the evidence shows, you know, from the Kauffman Foundation and others who do this kind of economic development research, that it is new businesses, startups, these smaller businesses that are just getting the start, that that's where the majority of your net new jobs come from in an economy. And I got to say, I know this from personal experience because I'm a small business owner. I started my business 5 years ago, had a great opportunity to build my business and grow it in Wisconsin. I know how challenging it is. I had a lot of luck and a lot of help. And we need to make sure that Wisconsin's a place where everyone can do that.
Well, speaking of that, the governor's organization, WEDIC, has not put much effort into creating jobs in the north. He didn't just turn down money for the train. The Walker administration turned down money for broadband, federal money from from the federal government for increasing broadband throughout the state. And places like Ashland and Medford and Rhinelander have sort of been left behind. How do you make sure that it isn't just Madison or the suburbs in Milwaukee that have these incubator projects where new businesses are starting?
Yeah. And did you know that I spent my early years in Medford?
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
home of Tombstone Pizza.
Taylor County. You got it. You got it. Yeah, in fact, I had a pet goat as a child. Her name was Penelope. So you're right. You know, there are a lot of places in Wisconsin that are really struggling. They're seeing younger people move away, not coming back. Their populations are going down. And the economic activity is declining. And so you don't have the kind of vibrant communities, especially in rural parts of the state, that we want and need. And that's part of the reason that I'm so passionate about small businesses, because we know that, you know, we could spend hundreds of millions of dollars trying to entice some big corporation to come and, you know, plop down a facility in the suburbs of Milwaukee, but that's really not going to benefit the people who are paying the bill in all the rest of the state.
Well, and we see what happened with Motorola in the suburbs of Chicago. They built and then they left.
So, you know, we can't let these companies just come take all the money and then leave. Instead, we have to look for the people who live in these communities and have great ideas and are hard workers and say, we're going to give you a chance. You know, maybe you can't access traditional bank financing because you're a first-time entrepreneur, but we're going to still help you get a loan so that you can buy equipment or start a business or hire someone to pursue your dream. That is how you create economic activity that benefits everyone and that stays in the community and is invested here in our state and is sustainable.
Two reform issues. There's been some debate about the Democrats and yourself over what happened when it came to redistricting reform, when the Democrats briefly had control of all three branches of government, and then also campaign finance reform. What is your what is your plan, and should the Democrats have done more to push redistricting reform when they were head power?
Well, this was one of my biggest disappointments from my time in the legislature when we had the majority. I've been a longtime supporter of nonpartisan redistricting. I don't think we should let politicians pick their lines and pick their voters. I think voters should get to elect the leaders that they choose and have a meaningful voice in that process. And in my first term in the state assembly, we had the majority. And it was for the first time that we had a Democratic governor, Senate, and assembly in many years. And I was really excited about that. Now, Spencer Black had for many years authored a nonpartisan redistricting bill like the Iowa Style Commission. And I and many others, you know, were very supportive of the idea. Spencer was the leader on that, and he was in negotiations with our Democratic leadership to try to get that bill passed. And, you know, finally we ended up actually losing the majority. And, you know, Spencer again brought it up and said, hey, you know, let's do this. Let's do the right thing. And now that we know we're not going to be drawing the lines ourselves, because I think, you know, that was part of why the leadership didn't want to pass it. They saw like, hey, we could actually draw some lines to benefit ourselves. Well, now we knew that wasn't going to happen. And so we had a big fight about it in caucus. And in our, you know, closed door meeting, basically that the Democratic Assembly representatives do to talk about what bills are going to go forward. And, you know, Spencer said we should do this. I and others spoke out and said, we really need to do this. This is the right thing to do. And unfortunately, you know, our leaders did not agree. And that was, I, you know, remember coming home and just being so dejected because we had failed to do the right thing, even though doing so would have probably been politically beneficial to us at that point since the Republicans had taken control.
Does it pay to do campaign finance reform anymore because of Citizens United?
Yes, there's still a lot we can do. You know, I've been a longtime board member of Common Cause. I think that we should have a public campaign financing program. I think we should do 100% public financing for all judicial races. That just makes sense. You can't have people buying judges. And I think we should have a low-dollar matching program that encourages people to go out and get small grassroots donations, like I and other Democrats have done, to raise money and fund our campaigns, and that you match it so that you don't have to be a millionaire or know a lot of millionaires to run for office and be a serious candidate. Now, I understand the world that we live in, and if we're going to go up against Walker and the Koch brothers, we have to have somebody who's willing to raise money and who's good at it. And that's why, you know, I'm actually very proud of the fact that we've raised over $1 million in this primary, because that means that people are investing in our campaign and they know that I'm the strongest candidate to beat Scott Walker. But I also know that this is a crazy way to have a political system, and we would be much better off if we made it easier for people, especially people without resources, to run for office and have their voices heard in a meaningful way in our government.
Well, that leads me to my final question as we wrap things up. A lot of people just think that the race ended with the last Marquette poll, that that's the Holy Grail, that, you know, they may not be that impressed with Tony Evers, but the race was over at that point. Now, that was before your ads and Malin Mitchell's ads and really Matt Flynn's ads started.
The race would be over before it had even begun, before anyone
right.
passed the ballot. That's crazy.
Right. It was kind of like the Wisconsin broadcasters debate. So, make your pitch. Is this a real race as we head down? And have you seen anything tangible since you went up on the air?
Absolutely. Yes. You know, we know that the vast majority of voters, even in that last poll, Marquette poll, were undecided. And we also know that folks have heard Tony Evers' name, but that doesn't mean that they necessarily are going to vote for him or support him. What we found in our poll was that after people heard our message, not only did the undecideds come to support me, but a good majority of Tony Evers supporters came to support me as well, a good number of those folks, and that we can win this primary. Now, I do think that, you know, here we are 11 days out, but so we're at a point where we've got the resources. Our campaign has the resources to get our message out. We've been on TV for 2 weeks getting that message out and are seeing things move and seeing support move in our direction. And so at this point, it's very likely that it's going to be either me or Tony Evers coming through this primary, because there just isn't enough time and the other candidates don't have enough money or resources to actually get their message out. All good people, all with something to offer the state. But, you know, realistically at this point in the primary, it's going to come down to me, or because we've got the resources and have been on TV, or Tony Evers because he starts with a slight advantage in name ID.
Kelda Royce, if people want to check out more information about you, where do they go?
Please check out our website, keldaforgovernor.com, or you can look at my Facebook page, Kelda Royce, or follow me on Twitter.
Kelda, stand by for just a sec. Thanks for coming to SliesOffice.com.
SliesOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
You know, we work hard every day in mills and mines, hospitals and schools, in office buildings, pharmacies and shipyards, factories and forests, in squad cars, ambulances and taxicabs. We do all kinds of jobs in Iowa, Wisconsin, Illinois, and all across the United States and Canada. We build the things that build our country. We do things that keep our country going, support our families and our communities. We have the courage to stand up even when no one else does. We have the strength to fight for what's right, for our families and for yours. We're your friends, your neighbors, your sisters and brothers. We're more than 1 million members strong. We stand in solidarity with workers in every continent on the globe. We're the United Steelworkers Union, and every day we fight for you. Please join our fight. Visit usw.org or like us at facebook.com/steelworkers.